You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. I'm Joe Casey, and today I'll be talking with a guest about the multidimensional nature of transitioning to life after full-time work. Our guest today is Dr. Barbara O'Neill. She's the author of the new book, Flipping a Switch, Your Guide to Happiness and Financial Security in Later Life. Dr. Barbara O'Neill is a CFP and AFC, and she's the owner and CEO of Money Talk, financial planning seminars and publications, where she writes, speaks, and reviews content about personal finance. A distinguished professor emeritus at Rutgers University after 41 years, she has written over 160 articles for academic publications and received over 35 national awards and over $1.2 million in grants to support her financial education programs and research. Dr. O'Neill is a past president of the Association for Financial Counseling and Planning Education, a recipient of the AFCPE Distinguished Fellow Award, and a Next Gen Personal Finance Fellow. Dr. O'Neill, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, I'm very glad to be here, Joe.
So just a few things have happened in the world since you decided to leave Rutgers University here in New Jersey and move to Florida. Could you tell us about the story of your transition so far?
Okay, well, my last day on the Rutgers University payroll was December 31st of 2019. And what I did is I took the week between Christmas and New Year's off of 2019. And on January 1st, I updated all my social media profiles and reestablished a business that I've had since 1992 called Money Talk. And it was pretty much a side hustle at the time. And I never had a website before because I worked for Rutgers, which was a public university, and we had different conflict of interest rules. So I kind of was a free agent on January 1st, 2020, and I ramped up my business, and I already had some projects in the pipeline. And of course, I was still in the process of writing my book. So I moved 1,200 miles from Northwest New Jersey to North Central Florida in the city of Ocala. And for 13 weeks, I was starting to get used to a new lifestyle. And I had joined the computer club and I had joined a bocce team with my husband. And I was writing chapters of the book and doing projects for clients. And then, of course, March 14th, everything shut down in our community. So there haven't been any face-to-face club meetings. All the events and activities were canceled. The gym was closed for about 3 or 4 months. And so it didn't start out the way I thought it would be as far as the transition goes. I mean, there's been a lot of changes and unexpected changes. Basically, what I've done is I talk about my six W's as a way of kind of addressing COVID. I do a lot of working and walking, writing, webinars, watching news, and also watching a lot of friends and family on Zoom, and then just kind of wondering what's going to happen next. So those are my six W's. I've tried to get involved with the community as much as I can. I joined the faculty of a local community education center called Master the Possibilities. And like I said, I joined the computer club, and I did start to volunteer at a thrift shop because I had done that back in New Jersey and I really enjoyed it. And I just gotten started with the training and everything. And then they shut down for a couple months, but I've come back and everybody works in masks and all the customers have to wear masks. So it's a pretty controlled environment. And we made a lot of home improvements to our house because we kind of repositioned money that might have been spent on travel to home improvements. So we did a lot of that this past year, as many Americans did. And I guess the big thing is I wrote so much in the book about socialization and finding new friends when you move to a new location and how difficult that can be in later life. And of course, COVID has kind of made that even worse because people are very reluctant to get close to one another. Again, a lot of activities have been canceled. Nobody's inviting anybody into their house. So it's been a little strange in that regard, but people are starting to get vaccinated, and hopefully, you know, by the end of this year, some of those things will start to turn around.
So what do you think the impact of the pandemic will be on retirement, both short-term and longer-term down the road?
Well, it's interesting. I think the answer probably is it depends. There's some anecdotal evidence this year, and not just anecdotal, but also some hard numbers too, that some people have retired earlier. They're starting to claim Social Security benefits. Some of them were laid off. Some of them were concerned about their risks due to COVID, like a number of older teachers, for example, apparently left the workforce. So there have been people who have taken COVID as kind of a reason to exit the workforce earlier. There are some people who are saying, let me do it later. I had a colleague at Rutgers who had planned to leave Rutgers at the end of 2020, but they went remote, and she's down here in Florida also, and she can do her work remotely and teach courses, so she's staying on longer. So I think, you know, it's changed people's opinions depending on the type of job that they have, maybe the resources that they have at their disposal, that sort of thing. I think some people perhaps have started to rethink long distance moves. I've talked to a number of people here down in Florida who predicated their whole move to Florida from either the Northeast or the central part of the country based on the fact that they could come and go anytime they wanted. They could go back and see their family could come and see them, they can travel. And of course, that was all put on hold. So some people might be thinking about that and wanting to maybe stay closer to where their roots are. I've been doing a number of programs about COVID recently, and basically Americans can be grouped in one of three categories. And this is people of all ages, including older adults. There's a group of people who have lost income and they're struggling. There's another group of people who have a stable income, but they're anxious, either anxious about layoffs or anxious about furloughs or the fact that they don't have very much emergency savings. And then the third group is people who have either had an increase in income and or a decrease in expenses because a lot of discretionary things are on hold. And these are people who have opportunities, whether it's philanthropic opportunities or savings opportunities, whatever the case might be. I think we've seen a lot of increased attention to estate planning. You know, I just looked up the number this morning for a blog post I was writing. We're in the neighborhood of 433,000 Americans who have died of COVID-19. And if that's not a wake-up call to get a will, a living will, and a durable power of attorney, I don't know what is. So I think there's been a lot of attention to that. And then one other thing that I noticed, Joe, is that, and I noticed this back in April of 2020, was that as I was finishing up my book, Flipping a Switch, was talking about all the transitions that people make in later life, particularly when they leave the workforce, many of those same transitions were the ones that people were making as a result of COVID-19. In fact, the Wall Street Journal had an article, Is COVID-19 a Preview of Retirement? And I thought about that quite a bit because there were many Americans who had experienced a change in income, either up and down, up or down. Many of them were struggling to create a paycheck of sorts by cobbling together different sources of income, very much like many retirees do. People were trying to keep busy. People were reporting too much togetherness, which often happens when spouses leave the workforce and spend a lot of time together. And then, of course, we had all sorts of issues related to fraud. And I just saw on Twitter just 5 minutes ago another notice from the CFPB about all the fake vaccine frauds that are coming out now. And older adults in general tend to be targets for fraud. So there were just a lot of similarities between COVID transitions and retirement transitions that older adults make.
That's a great point. And your book, Flipping a Switch, paints the picture that later life is really about multiple transitions, financial, social, lifestyle factors that, as you note, often take place simultaneously. So in the workshops and the other types of work that you do, where do you see people being the most and the least prepared?
Well, again, I think the answer is it depends. I think there are people out there who have done a good job on preparing for the financial side of retirement, but maybe not so much on the social and lifestyle. And then you have people who have really good social capital and good connections and relationships, and maybe they're struggling with their finances. And then I'm sure there are people who have issues with all three areas, the financial, the social, and the lifestyle changes. In doing research for the book and just weekly blog posts that I write and everything, what I've come to realize, and this has been reported a lot in the media too, is that underlying issues make everything a challenge, whether it's COVID or retirement. So people have underlying financial issues like low savings and high debt. And then there's also all the underlying health issues, you know, diabetes, overweight, and those sorts of things. So I think that's something that kind of every situation is different. I don't know that you can just generalize and say that people were affected in one way, but I guess the underlying message is the more planning that you can do, the more positives that you have, you know, what I call resiliency resources, things that can help you back bounce back from challenges. I think the more of those you have in your life, the easier any type of transition is going to be, whether it's COVID or losing a job, leaving a job to retire, because you're just going to have more resources at your disposal.
So I know you're not a fan of the R word, and unfortunately, it's included in the title of my podcast, but or many of the replacement words for retirement. And I noticed that you describe your transition very differently, using different language, and I wonder if you'd be willing to share that, and also talk a little bit about the identity bridge that you write about in your book.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I have a chapter that kind of talks about the word retirement and all the other alternatives, you know, rewirement and refirement, and people come out with a lot of rewords. And re just really means that you're repeating something that you didn't want to repeat in the first place. Like, if you don't want to talk about retirement, you probably don't want to talk about refirement or wirement either. I just personally think that the word, the R word, is just loaded with a lot of baggage, because people's perceptions of retirement may not be your perceptions of retirement. So about 2 years before I started, before I actually left Rutgers, if people would ever inquire, I would just say, I'm leaving Rutgers. And even, you know, when it got pretty close and people knew I was leaving, they'd say, oh, I hear you're retiring. I said, no, I'm leaving Rutgers. And then after I left Rutgers, people would say, oh, you retired. I said, no, I left Rutgers. So I've had to do that for about 2-3 years, just kind of re-educate people, because people have this tendency to impose what researchers call a social clock on other people. And a social clock is a perception of what people should do at a certain age. So people will talk to maybe a son and daughter-in-law who are married, and maybe they're in their early 30s, and it's like, well, when are you going to give me a grandchild? They're imposing their social clock on their children, and that's not right. And then neither is saying to somebody at a certain age, well, when are you going to retire? Or how come you haven't retired yet? So I'm just not a really big fan. In fact, I look at role models for my life, and I see four key role models for people who are productive at a later age. And that would be Janet Yellen, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Warren Buffett, and Dr. Fauci. And they are my role models for how life can be after you leave your primary career. So identity bridging is just a concept that I found when I was researching the book, of keeping important facets of your working life in your post-work life. And it doesn't have to be work, although it could be. For me, it's been working in the financial education field, which I continue to do as a financial education entrepreneur. So it is working. For me, it's also blogging, being a thrift shop volunteer, which I mentioned before, and keeping contact and association, you know, with professional associations, not all of the ones that I belonged to when I was at Rutgers, but some of them. And what the researchers have found is that if you do some kind of identity bridging, you take some of your old life and bring it into your new life, it increases your comfort level because you're not just going cold turkey into a completely different lifestyle. So it's almost like those patches when people quit smoking and, you know, they kind of, you know, put the patch on and it gives them a lesser amount of nicotine. Well, it's kind of like the same thing. You're kind of ramping down what you did before and keeping some of it so that you're not cold turkey, say, you know, waking up the next day after you leave your job and saying, okay, now what do I do? That's kind of a prescription for unhappiness for a lot of people.
So you mentioned your four key role models. Great list. What stands out about the four of them to you? And I noticed one of them you dedicated the book to.
Yeah, I dedicated Flipping a Switch to Dr. Fauci. And what I really wrote was just the fact that all four of the people I mentioned are exemplary models of people who are making a difference in the last third of their life with their time, with their expertise. And that's just so important. And I also think, well, nobody questions them that they're working when they're 80 years old. So why should they be questioning me? You know, so I just think that, okay, they're my great role models. Now, of course, in those cases, they've all been kind of in the same field, but then so am I. You know, Janet Yellen was at the Fed and now she's at Treasury. So she's changed careers too. So if she can stay in the national financial expertise role, so can I. And I think it's really important to have role models because quite honestly, I don't have any other role models in my life of people who have continued a career after they left their primary job. So I hope I can be a role model for other people. And several people have told me that already, that, wow, when I leave my job, I'm going to do what you do. I want to start a financial education business. So I think it's important to have some models of people to follow and then try to be a model for others as well.
And what I hear in your story is something I see in a lot of people I work with, which is you're not doing just one thing. You've got your own portfolio of interests and activities and things you're involved in that probably provide you with some different sources of satisfaction.
Yeah, definitely. And also, as I found when I was researching the book, there's that whole concept of having some big rocks in your day. If you remember the old Stephen Covey analogy where you put the big rocks into the jar first and then you kind of put the sand and the small rocks around it. Well, that works out pretty well for people when they're trying to structure their days in later life is to have some big rocks. And again, it doesn't have to be paid work. It could be volunteer work. It could be caregiving for grandchildren. It can be whatever brings you joy and happiness, but it's also something that's going to take a lot of your time because I wrote in the book that when you leave a full-time job, you've got a lot of hours there. You've got to fill about 2,500 hours a year. That's a lot of hours to fill and having some things that you really enjoy doing that can kind of anchor your days will be really important.
I'm so glad to see Big Rocks from Stephen Covey in your book, and I'm so glad you brought it up in our discussion today. If this was video, you would see I have a clear vase filled with rocks from a beach in Massachusetts in the Big Rock concept. And I often send some of my executive coaching clients actually the Big Rock video, which is still out there, even though it's dated in terms of clothing for Stephen Covey. Because it's such a key and useful concept, so thanks for mentioning that. So another topic, you note in your book that letting go and looking forward are both important. Why can these two straightforward things be challenging in transitions?
Well, you think about it. When you've been in a career pattern, let's say for, I don't know, 40 years, 50 years, and then all of a sudden you're not, it's kind of like jumping off a cliff. And you're going to this unknown place, whether you call it retirement or you call it leaving Rutgers or whatever it is, it's a different place than you you've had before. So anything that's new and uncertain can often be stressful, you know, and that's anything in life. I think also as you leave a career and you're in the latter third of your life, you're also thinking about mortality, possibly thinking about doing things for the last time. Have I gone to Broadway in New York City for the last time? I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. I may have. So you think about those things. And then also there's the whole process of disengaging, you know, just figuring out how to get out of things, how to like step away. And I interviewed one woman for the book, and she talked about how she just hung on to her job because she couldn't find a good replacement. She said the replacements weren't good enough, so I had to stay on. And that's too bad. I mean, there should be a way to kind of disengage, probably mentor somebody coming up through the ranks, trying to share different ways of doing the job, and then just handing it over to them. But the logistics of doing that can be very difficult in real life. So sometimes people find that to be pretty jarring. And then, of course, COVID has made everything harder because, like I said before, a lot of people's plans blew up as a result of the pandemic. So whether it's plans to be snowbirding, travel, you know, I talked to a friend in New Jersey a few weeks ago who told me, he's an older gentleman, he told me that it was the first time in 35 years that he hadn't been down to Florida to winter. So that can be hard for a lot of people too. So again, it's just addressing the uncertainties, you know, the uncertainties of what you're leaving behind, and then also the uncertainties of what lies ahead.
So your book is loaded with practical tips, very valuable ones, on flipping switches, not just one, but I counted them. I think I counted them right. 35 in all.
35.
And they go, yep. Yeah. And they go across all those three transitions you mentioned, financial, social, and lifestyle, in those three categories. What do you see as some of the most challenging switches to flip?
Okay. Yeah. There's 35 in the book, and there's 15 financial, 5 social, and 15 that are kind of in the lifestyle area. Yeah. I'll talk about a few of those. One, I think, is just developing those big rocks that I talked about before. Just figuring out, okay, what will be the anchors to my day? And of course, that's been so difficult here in this 55 plus community that I moved to, because again, a lot of those anchors that people had counted on, social activities, club organizations, all those things, events have all gone by the wayside. But developing the big rocks is important. Making friends is also important too. And I found a number of resources that just talked about how difficult that can be for people as they're older, because the two things that often help people make friends when they're younger don't exist when you're older. And that would be children and jobs. So people have to look elsewhere to make friends. And one of the things I've noticed here that's been a real way to bring people together, and one of the few things that's open actually, is the dog park. Because people are able, they have the chairs socially distanced, and of course the dogs are running around. And it's we actually have two dog parks here. We have the under 35 pound dog park and the over 35 pound dog park. So that's a place where people can come together. So, but making friends can be difficult. Changes in income, particularly for people who are living on a reduced income, that's going to be a challenge for a lot of people. But I also talk in the book about the fact that people who have actually done a great job of saving have challenges in spending down their savings. So that's a big issue. Some others that come to mind would be long-term care, dementia. In the next to last chapter, I talk about certain events that could or could not happen, kind of wildcard events. Downsizing, there's a whole chapter on downsizing and kind of paring down possessions. And then another issue that I talk about in the social section of the book is people who are solo agers, people who will be going into, you know, later life at some point, maybe not when they first start to retire, but at some point later, they will be people who do not have a spouse or children to take care of them, and then some different things that they need to consider when they don't have the same family supports as others.
So as a professor, you're very familiar with the difference between theory and practice, and you've written a great book. But I'm wondering if you could reflect and share with us, what are the biggest lessons you've learned in navigating your own transition at this point?
Yeah, well, okay, that's a fair question. Am I walking my talk? I think what I've learned is that I am very happy when I work, and I am very happy to remain a player in the financial education field. And I hope to do that well into my 80s, just as Dr. Fauci, who just turned 80, is a leading epidemiologist. I hope to be the same kind of person in financial education. I think I've learned the importance of happiness hacks and the importance of gratitude. Nature, particularly walking outside in nature and just being outdoors, smiling. I heard something recently on a program that you should follow the 10-5 rule, that if somebody is 10 feet away, and of course, this is really appropriate for COVID now, if somebody is 10 feet away, you smile at them. And if they're 5 feet away, and let's make it 6 for COVID, you say hello. And that 10-5 rule, it apparently has been proven to just make people smile more. And that is a happiness hack. So I think that's so important. And then I've also learned a lot of entrepreneurship tips that I guess I just kind of figured them out. I blogged about a couple of them. The importance of being visible on social media. I've always been very visible on Twitter, but I never did much with LinkedIn when I was at Rutgers because I figured it was more to get a new job and I was happy working at Rutgers. So I didn't really engage with it very much. But when I did, all of a sudden, like in January, I started posting things and going back and forth with people, and I got job offers through LinkedIn, and I started getting all those notifications, you're being noticed, which I never got before. So I think that was important. I also learned the value of pro bono work. Not every hour that I worked in 2020 was a billable hour. And actually, some of the most satisfying work that I did last year was for pro bono, whether it was webinars or podcasts or something like that. I got a Zoom license. I think that was really important. It helped me to connect with friends and family. We started a group of people who worked at Rutgers. We started it in April when I got the Zoom license. And every Friday at 4 o'clock, we Zoom. And it has kept us connected for the entire year. It's just been great for everybody in the group to feel like we have some social connections. So my Zoom license is getting a big workout between the work that I do with clients and then my cousins and I, we Zoom every 2 or 3 Sundays. So it's just been great. I can't say enough about, you know, $150 a year for all the connections that I've made. It's been wonderful. And then the other thing I would just say is just say no to things that are bad fits for you. And I've turned down probably as much work as I took on last year, just because it wasn't a good fit for me. There were either some problems with the expected deliverables, or it just wasn't a good match for my skill set. And I just said no. And in many cases, I referred the potential client to somebody else who I knew could do a better job for them than I could. So that was an important thing that I learned as well.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's a sometimes overlooked skill, the ability to say no. And as you're doing, redirecting, so it can really help both parties.
Yeah, well, I mean, one case, the client was just unsure about what they wanted. And I just thought, gee, if you're having so much trouble kind of telling me what you want before I become work for you, what's it going to be like when I work for you? And I said, no, that's not going to happen. And then another one was online teaching, and it was just so nebulous as to the amount of hours that would be required. And then somebody wanted me to basically ghostwrite their research so that they could get tenure, and got some ethical issues there. That was an easy no. And then more recently, somebody approached me about doing a bias review for personal finance content. And I just said no because, A, I'm not a person of color, and I haven't experienced a lot of the bias that people of color would have. And then second of all, I figured there has to be some training to do that kind of work, and I haven't had that training. So again, I referred them back to somebody who I knew was hiring a bias editor for their project. And I said, talk to them and find out who they're using. So you have those situations, and that's fine.
So another topic that got my attention that you covered in your book is the FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early. And it gets a lot of attention. You recommend an alternative, FIND, F-I-N-D instead of F-I-R-E. What's different about FIND?
I think, well, FIRE is financial independence, retire early. And the biggest proponents of that are people who are trying to exit the workforce, maybe in their early 40s, mid 40s. And it's gotten a lot of attention. I actually watched that documentary film that was produced a few years ago called Playing with Fire. There were actually two Playing with Fires that came out. One had to do with firemen, and then the other one had to do with financial independence, retire early. And I don't know, all I could think of is, okay, so you exit the workforce at 40 or 50, you're going to have all those same flip switches that I wrote about in my book that people often face when they're a bit older. And I'm thinking, what are you going to do with the next 50, possibly 60 years of your life? If you truly use the word retire, are you really going to retire? And in fact, many of the leading proponents of FIRE are people who have just transitioned to self-employment, pretty much like I have. So I just think FIND is a whole better acronym because it's financial independence, new directions. And you get to choose those directions. Like I said before, it could be volunteer work. It could be becoming an entrepreneur when you've been a salaried employee. I also noticed back in Jersey, I used to get lots of inquiries where people who have had corporate careers wanted to have academic careers. And they would contact me and say, well, how do you get to be a professor at Rutgers? So I think a lot of people are just looking for something new and different. Because I think about my parents a lot. You know, when they retired in the traditional way, they were, my father was 65 and he was tired of commuting from Long Island to New York City. And my mother was 62 and she basically quit her job because they were going to go on a cruise and her boss wouldn't let her go on the cruise to take the time. So she says, okay, I'm out of here, I quit. And, you know, they came back from the cruise and they were both kind of just kind of wondering what to do. And they had some caregiving issues with my grandparents for a while and that kept them busy. And then when that ended, they were still kind of like struggling for what am I going to do next? And I knew I didn't want to be in that situation. And I really think most people don't either. People want to have new directions. And I think that's why I think FIND is a better acronym because I think it expresses what the people who call the FIRE movement is really about people getting free from, you know, the 9-to-5 employment situation to chart their own path. And I just think new directions is a better way to kind of describe that new path. So that's my take on it.
I appreciate that. You mentioned Broadway plays as something that you had been very interested in the past and wondering when that's going to come back, if you'll come back to see them. What's one or two of your favorites of all time that you had a chance to see?
Oh, well, I went on a Broadway binge right before I left New Jersey. I did get to see Hamilton. That was amazing. I saw Evan Hansen, Dear Evan Hansen. I saw the Come From Away, Wicked. I mean, there were just a whole lot of plays that I saw. I think Hamilton was the most amazing experience just because that whole day was just like magical when we went in because that was our last time in New York City.
And the last thing I saw was To Kill a Mockingbird, which was quite an experience as well. Nothing like the Broadway plays.
Exactly.
So when do you think people should begin to start planning for life after full-time work, whether it's FIRE, FIND, or a more traditional path? When should the planning begin?
Well, Well, I think there's different types of planning that people can do at different ages. For example, I would say you should start saving for financial security in later life. Notice I didn't use the R word. You'll save for that financial security. Ideally, you want to do that in your first job out of post-secondary school, whatever it is, whether you go to college or trade school or whatever your first job is after your post-secondary training, start saving. You know, get into a 401k, start a Roth IRA. Those would be some things that you can start immediately. Another thing that you can kind of consider doing throughout your working life would be possibly having some side hustles, using whatever your skills are that you have. Now, obviously, you have to be careful because you may have certain rules through your primary employer as to how much outside employment you can take on. I know I had rules at Rutgers. I couldn't do anything in the state of New Jersey because I was a public employee in the state of New Jersey. So you have to, of course, abide by those rules. But, you know, building up your knowledge and your skills and your contacts through your side hustles can really help. And you can be doing that for 30, 40 years, just not only building up your skills, but also having more money, obviously, because you're earning more to be able to save. But I think, you know, when it comes down to really serious planning, I think it was Prudential Securities years ago had an ad campaign called The Red Zone, where they talked about the 5 years before your exit date and the 5 years after. And those would be, you know, your red zone where you're really digging in to get information and making plans and reviewing your options and learning all the nuances of Social Security and Medicare and your employer plans if you have them. That would be, you know, something you would do later in life. And then probably just getting ongoing financial advice, either on a regular basis if you become a client of a financial planner, for example, or on an as-needed basis, you know, when you have certain issues that come up, that can be helpful for people as well.
Dr. O'Neill, thank you so much for taking the time to discuss your book with us and really got a lot out of reading the book and this conversation as well. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, Joe. I appreciate it.
Really appreciate Dr. Barbara O'Neill taking the time to talk with us today. She raised a lot of great points in our discussion. I'd like to take a few minutes to highlight some that stood out to me. First up, her comments on the R word, the word retirement. Despite what you might think, given the name of this podcast, I agree with her. It's inadequate. I think it implies a standard lifestyle and a standard timeline that's really not a reality for many people today. In the work I do as a coach in this space, I see it's really different for almost everyone. People are leaving the world of full-time work at different times and in different ways. Their life situations are often very different. But what I see is they all have one thing in common. They're looking for what's next. They're not really done yet. And what's next for them is not immediately clear. The ones I work with discover clarity over a period of time. They're not interested in working full-time anymore, but they are interested in finding ways to leverage their expertise, their experience, and their skills in some new ways. And they're often ways that are meaningful to them and helpful to others at the same time. Some are starting businesses. Some are creating new consulting opportunities on a part-time basis. Some are pursuing creative things. And some are even going back to school to pivot, to take on something new. And a few are working on some very interesting initiatives that I think will have significant impact in their communities. So I think Dr. O'Neill captured the essence of transitioning to this next phase of life. And that's about the opportunity. As she pointed out, when you leave the full-time world of work, you get an average of 2,500 hours per year. Question is, how are you going to use that? And how do you think about it? See it as a gift or as a burden? A problem to be solved about how you're going to fill those hours. Second point that jumped out to me is her notion of the social clock. That was new to me. But thinking about it, people are not shy about expressing their expectations these days about what other people should do. It's usually based on what everyone else is doing or has done in the past. And for some people, that becomes a limiting factor that they have to deal with in thinking about what's next for them. And it's ironic because when you think of it, this phase of life is really about freedom that people work really hard to attain. And a key challenge becomes preparing for not letting other people's expectations get in your way. Especially when you think of it, when those expectations are based on an old model of life that's not really relevant, perhaps, for you. Third point she made is her comment on the FIRE model and her alternative, financial independence, retire early, the FIRE movement. And she suggests a new way, financial independence and new directions. I think that's really spot on. So in summary, check how you're thinking about this next phase of life. Do you see it as an opportunity or a problem? And how are you going to maximize those 2,500 hours that you'll have coming your way? Secondly, simply reject other people's notions of their social clock, what their expectations are of what you should do. Find your own pathway. And embrace that it's really about taking the abilities you have to find the new directions right for you. I highly recommend Dr. O'Neill's book. I like her multidimensional perspective. She sees the main things that are in front of you when you're transitioning or during a transition, and she breaks it down into very practical and useful steps you can take. As we mentioned, there are 35 switches she's identified to flip, and there are useful tips that everyone can use. And given her background, it's no surprise that this book is really solidly researched. She surveyed the research in the field, and her recommendations are solidly backed. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can find all our episodes at retirementwisdom.com. We're now in our fourth season, so you can look through previous seasons and find conversations that can help you find the pathway that's right for you. Keep an eye out for an upcoming program that I'm launching in the next few weeks. I'll be offering a six-week Designing Your Life coaching program for a group of what's limited to be 10 people. But it's a chance to go through the Designing Your Life group process with other people and learn from others to begin to design your own pathway and what's next for you.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.